BBC FM with Phil Gibbons and Joanne Schofield on BBC Radio Bristol.
Hello again, it's us two, and loads happening in the show today.
We'll be talking to our volunteer presenter, John Barker.
In being fair to others, and in honest politics, and this is who I am. I believe in never walking away from people in difficult times. This is what I stand for.
He's reshuffled his cabinet as a succession of ministers have resigned. Jeff Hoon and Margaret Beckett are following James Purnell in leaving top jobs. Alan Johnson has been promoted from Health to Home Secretary. Local election results so far show the Labour vote crumbling in England. The Conservatives have made a net gain of 6 councils so far. They won Derbyshire after 28 years of Labour. Andrew Lewer is a Tory councillor there.
We've had a sort of barrier to break through, in a sense. The first thing many people have talked about has been expenses and Westminster and so on. We've been able to break through that and start talking about the local issues, which is what we spend all our time doing here.
Meanwhile, Labour's Ian Gibson has resigned as an MP with immediate effect, triggering a by-election in Norfolk. He was one of 4 Labour MPs told he couldn't stand for the party again because of expenses allegations. Elsewhere, Scotland Yard says only a handful of MPs could face full criminal inquiries into their expenses claims. Senior officers and prosecutors have announced they want more information on a small number of allegations. In other news, 27 more people have swine flu in Britain, bringing the total number of cases to 486. 5 people are still in hospital with the virus in Glasgow. Some veterans of D-Day have travelled to the ceremony marking its 65th anniversary wearing pictures of the Queen. They say the badges are in protest at a treatment by the French authorities who didn't invite her. And there's been a surprise return to winter for parts of northern England. Some June snow has fallen in parts of Cumbria and the Pennines. Roads stayed clear, but some flakes did settle on hillsides in the Upper Teesdale and Weardale areas. That's the latest. I'm Ben James.
Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Early next month on 4th June is local election day and BCFM is on the road and kick off the line.
With news, community champions in the spotlight and some of the best in local music, you can hear Dialect on BCFM every Saturday at 9pm or subscribe to our podcast on the web at dialectradio.co.uk or visit Bristol Indymedia. Bristol's community magazine show, now in its 5th year.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Election Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and coming up in the next hour, my guests and I will be going through some of the Bristol local election results. With hundreds of thousands of votes being cast in Bristol yesterday, how has the party political spread in the city changed? And if it has, is there likely to be any wider political shift? Political pundit Martin Summers is here too to untangle some of the jargon around this week's news and give his perspective. Drive Time's Neil Roberts is away this week with a sprained ankle. Get soon, well soon, Neil. But Adam Dabrowski is here instead from Sunday evening's Polish show with a look at attempts to redevelop Castle Park. We also have Marina Morris on the demographic crisis in Europe. But before that, here's our special two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures around about 11, 12 degrees Celsius. Rain will be clearing up by Sunday evening. And next week will be warmer, 15 to 18 Celsius, but it will be a rainy week, with the rain reducing to only drizzle by the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of June, temperatures high again, around 18, 19 Celsius. Still a bit cloudy, but thankfully, next weekend, no rain. And the week after next, around about 16 degrees, sunny periods, and rain-free, so a much nicer week. and the winds will be light for the next couple of weeks. So I'm joined now by author and pundit Martin Summers, as well as Liberal Democrat councillor for Eastfield, Steve Coomer. Welcome to the studio, guys. Now, we'll be taking a look at yesterday's local elections. Before that, let's try disentangling with both of you some of the jargon and the spin behind this week's news. Now, one of the interesting little items I noticed was the fact that there are even questions over whether or not the entire country of Ireland is bankrupt. Martin, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, what can you say? I mean, what's happened with governments all over the world taking on the debts of the private banks? Then the question now is whether governments are bankrupt, and not just the Irish government. We're also talking about, for example, the United States government. The long term interest rate in the United States is going up. This means that the Federal Reserve has lost control of monetary policy. The US can't borrow money. Never mind Ireland. That's where we're at.
But you see, certainly in the States, I mean, we were told that they're running a massive deficit all the time. Isn't it just really a question of whether the banks are prepared to continue to extend these loans and extend them? And they're only bankrupt, really, when the banks change their mind and say, right, we're calling that loan back in.
Are we talking about countries or banks here?
Well, about loans to countries. Yeah.
The problem is that bankrupt banks are lending loans to countries, and it's all become quite surreal and Alice in Wonderland, hasn't it? You know, frankly, the people in charge are making it up as they go along here. We're in completely uncharted territory.
So, any predictions with Ireland? You know, is Ireland a safe bet? You know, as an economy.
I mean, I wouldn't say a safe bet, but clearly. I mean, a country can't go bankrupt in quite the same way that a company can. I mean, we've seen this before. We've seen this with hyperinflation in places like Zimbabwe. We've seen the situation with Brazil, I think, 20 years ago, where they had spiralling debt. So it's ultimately any country is underwritten by their taxpayers. So I can't see Ireland going bankrupt. But one of the things that is the Irish economy does have in common with the UK economy is it did overheat. I mean, the well-worn phrase, the Celtic Tiger of 15 years ago, was fine for a while, and that was sort of raging, and a lot of EU money was flowing in. Of course, since you've then had expansion in the EU, and some of the Objective 1 and 2 funding has now moved on to other places. But I think the biggest problem in the sort of Anglo-Saxon world is the whole basis of borrowing money to lend money and the whole spiral of particularly the housing market, where you've had a situation where there's a price spiral being chased by ever easier credit, leading to a price spiral, leading to a demand for more credit. And I think we saw, I mean, Northern Rock was the first sign of that coming unstuck. But I think eventually it always would. It was just a question of when and where it would hit. And I think it's significant that it hit in the English-speaking world rather than, say, France or Germany or the Netherlands, where the regulations were a bit tighter.
Okay, so moving on to a similar subject, but also another obscure story that I dug out was that JP Morgan Chase, one of the big American banks, is buying supertankers, which apparently are lying idle. Many supertankers now are lying idle because of the credit crunch, or whatever you want to call it. That and they're buying up these tankers and using them to store oil. Do you think that's something that we might see more of, or is this just a little one-off blip?
Is this for me to answer? Well, what's happening here is that speculation continues even in the middle of a fantastic economic catastrophe. And what's happened by the bailout of the banks in the US and Britain is that the speculators have been given a whole new round of money to bet. What's shocking is that US banks, who have been bailed out by the taxpayer, have used that taxpayer's money to set up a lobbying group to lobby Congress not to regulate the derivatives market. So just follow the logic of this. We pay money to the banks, they then use the money we've given them to lobby our representatives not to be regulated. Yeah. So we're paying for propaganda against our own best interests. And Obama, of course, a much better bet, and I'm sure that Steve will agree with me,
than
the alternative. But at the same time, we're in such a desperate situation. that Obama is not doing the right thing from my point of view. I mean, Steve can comment if he likes, but I mean, Obama's economics team are Wall Street insiders, Rubin, all of these people, Lawrence Summers, Ben Bernanke. They are the people who deregulated in the first place. So, and they've all been brought in. See, Obama, in normal times, Obama would finesse this by saying, well, of course, I've got to have a stable, normal economics team. But this isn't normal times. He should have had people like Krugman, like Stiglitz, like possibly James Galbraith. They should have been in his economics team, but they're all out. Now, I was looking for a balanced team, perhaps, you know, a bit of a Wall Street insider and a bit of university economics. But no, it's all Wall Street. And that's very sad because Obama, a lot of hopes were riding on Obama. I don't know what Steve's doing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't claim to have your knowledge of you know, the more theoretical side of economics. But what I would say, where I'm a bit optimistic with Obama, is I think he does see problems and he does look for solutions. And one of the problems he clearly identified with America is a lack of investment in infrastructure, which has been going on for decades. And I think we could see almost a sort of 21st century version of the New Deal actually resolving that problem. And sometimes you have to say, well, are there benefits from economic slowdown and recession? And I think there can be if you make these sort of investments and if you take stock and look at where things went wrong. In the wider context here, I mean, it always strikes me that when you have high unemployment, there's always work that needs doing. And if the work is done, as John Maynard Keynes, famous liberal economist, once said, then it is worth actually doing it because that generates economic activity. And, you know, this is a small thing, but certainly on in Bristol City Council on the budget, my group, Liberal Democrats, proposed that we invest in home insulation. Now, you can do that on a small scale locally, far better if you did it on a bigger scale, because one of the problems with the energy situation is we keep being told there's a huge demand for energy. Well, you can only do two things. You either produce more or you consume less. And I think one of the things we've got to look at is up until now, we've looked at how we can produce more. And I think we ought to be looking in some of these areas at how we can consume less. And I think there are things that could be done to help incentivise that.
Right, something else that's popped up in the news this week is that the World Health Organization are saying that swine flu is not swine flu. In fact, it looks as if it's actually not related to pigs at all, and that they're now trying to get everyone to call it Mexican flu. Only thing is, of course, everyone's still calling it swine flu. What do you think about that, folks?
Well, ask doctors, not us, is what I say to that.
Yeah, I think we've always seen this with various names for diseases and so on. I think it was a country, it was Egypt or somewhere, that, you know, slaughtered pigs as a result, and of course there's nothing to do with them. But no, I think it's clearly epidemics. One of the things I think is happening, I'm no great health expert, I think we're now identifying strains of virus much more clearly than perhaps we did 50 or 60 years ago. And perhaps we're getting more accurate about what different strains are, but you know, it'll always be a cat and mouse game of trying to fix things at a particular time.
Okay, now before we go on to talk about the local elections, let's have a discussion about Gordon Brown under siege. Now, to what extent do you both think that this is you know, some sort of political horse trading play, and to what extent is Gordon Brown really up against it here? I mean, we've had James Purnell, Hazel Blears, Jeff Hoon, Margaret Beckett, you know, quite a few senior figures there resigning, and this is all obviously putting pressure on Gordon Brown. But it's peculiar, isn't it, that this has happened just around at the time of the election? I mean, why these people aren't really loyal, are they?
No, hang on. Can I just say, it's not peculiar that it happens around the time of the election. These are the pressure points in British politics.
Yeah.
So that's when the stuff comes out, for obvious reasons. I mean, obviously, I'm a Labour Party activist, and I'm not very happy about the situation from our point of view. It's a bit messy. But I'm sure Steve will agree with me. In the long run, serious stuff does have to be dealt with, and we're now facing a very serious situation. And I think that, in my view, the Labour government has failed in many respects in what it should have been doing. Steve will no doubt agree with me about much of what we think were failures.
But, I mean, these people are pretty much the old new Labourites, aren't they? I mean, not necessarily Margaret Beckett, but many of the others were seen to be quite loyal to Tony Blair. So do you think there's an element here of the sort of resurrection of the spirit of Tony Blair?
Yeah, Margaret Beckett was originally Tony Benn's protégé, wasn't
she? Well, that's right. I mean, she goes right back to the Callaghan government. In fact, I think she's one of their only links with that now. I just have a feeling sometimes you get a stage in politics where governments just run out of steam, literally, and I think we're in that game. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the last days of the Callaghan government, and certainly the last days of the Thatcher Major years. And you know, you got to a stage, particularly in the mid 90s, where I mean, I was talking about this actually with somebody who was helping me in the election, who's 23, so doesn't remember it too clearly. And I said, no, this is very much the same situation to me as the early mid 90s. You had an economic problem. Black Wednesday in 92, the run on the banks and so on in the current period. And you then had the government's competence to run the economy questioned. And I think that's the problem. And once that starts to happen, and Gordon Brown personally, because he was Chancellor, had a lot of kudos by actually fostering the illusion that the economy was successful. I don't think it was. I think a lot of it was built castles in the air on rising house prices and credit. Mm-hmm. But now what's happening, that's starting to unravel. And some people are obviously, there's internal argument, the widely reported in the case of Hazel Blears. It's been quite strange for me, actually, because one of the things about being very active in local election campaigns is that you don't see TV news much, but it almost
too busy.
You're too busy, and it almost seemed like every time I went home or every time I was driving around and heard the news at the top of the hour that another minister had gone, and I thought I'd heard the end of that with Hazel Blears. I then go to my election count yesterday, and one of the other parties told me that James Purnell had gone. I then heard he'd written this letter saying that Gordon Brown should go, which sounds very much like a young Secretary of State jumping off the sinking ship into the lifeboat to protect himself. The latest ones are news to me coming in today. But I mean, what it does show to me is a government in decay and death throes, really. And I'm not sure how much they can keep this going. Constitutionally, yes, they could struggle on to next June. I just have a feeling that Brown's days are numbered, and I think there will be a movement within the Parliamentary Labour Party to at least go into damage limitation mode and put someone conciliatory like Alan Johnson in his place.
But Martin, surely if these people were loyal to the party as a whole, they wouldn't be jumping off the sinking ship. It was quite interesting, and I'm not absolutely sure the ship is sinking, but you know, there was this thing with Hazel Blears and her brooch that she was wearing on the day she resigned, which said "rocking the boat." Now that almost seems like cocking a snook at Gordon Brown.
I think part of the problem is I'm a Labour Party activist. I've been a member of the Labour Party since 1975. And I've never believed in New Labour. Many, many Labour activists never did, as I'm sure Steve realises. Mm. We never believed in it.
I do, but the problem is, in my election, my first election 4 years ago, back when I got on the City Council, I mean, it's very interesting because we were in arguments with New Labour on a range of issues, Iraq, tuition fees, council tax and so on. And my Labour opponent then said that he wasn't New Labour. But, I mean, I think a lot of people who weren't were happy to ride on the coattails when it was popular. And I had an interesting view of Tony Blair. And I actually had this worry that underneath, perhaps there was a reformer there. But it's almost as if when you
didn't do anything about PR, did he?
No, he didn't. And I think that's the strange thing. My biggest criticism about... I have two big criticisms about the Blair years. Firstly, there was no referendum on proportional representation, which clearly there should have been and was winnable. And equally, I think Blair in 1998-99 could have taken us in, could have won a referendum on the euro. I think it was winnable then, it was difficult. But at that time, you had Liberal Democrat support. You also had people like Ken Clark and Michael Heseltine from the Tory party who would have come out and backed a referendum. Now, I actually feel that had we joined the euro at that time, then we would be much stronger now. Now is not the time to join the euro, but that's the history of Britain's relationship with Europe. We join everything too late when it costs too much.
Can I also say that your party had a very principled position on the Iraq war, which I absolutely respect, and that also made a big difference to people's perception of our party. Your party were able, and all credit to you, to take what I would regard as the principal stand, and we paid the price for being unable to think it through and to fudge the most important issue that faced the government in all that time.
So do you think that the Labour Party, they've embraced New Labour, and now they're going to reject New Labour, and they've had enough of this, and moving on, are they going to be moving on? Because, I mean, essentially, it seems that the New Labour project was something which many people in the party felt they had to win that 1997 election and to get Blair in power.
Well, if I think back to the Labour Party in the 70s, we were talking about the Callaghan government, and like all political parties, which are staffed by people who are supported by people who've got political ideals, there's a danger that you end up just talking to yourself. And that's what happened to the Labour Party in the late 70s. We were just talking to ourselves, and we weren't talking to the population at large. And it was very important to modernise the way we approach things, if you like, in terms of just communicating with people, for goodness sake.
And it's not just the Labour Party. I mean, we saw it with the Conservative Party after the collapse of the John Major government. They were talking to themselves and standing out there in College Green and pinstripe suits, banging on about Europe, which at that stage wasn't high on people's...
Nobody cares.
That's right. And that people are not that interested in the precise details of treaties. Equally, in my own party doesn't have quite that tradition, but certainly I was around at the time of the Liberal-SDP merger that created the Liberal Democrats, and at that time we suffered because we were talking to each other, and we had our worst election result 20 years ago in the Euro elections, largely because of that. We seemed internally preoccupied with constitutional matters, and that doesn't work. But I mean, going back to the essential issue of New Labour, I think it is very strange to me looking at politics, because you almost see things mirrored and you see things coming back again. And I see with David Cameron a sort of Tony Blair light in a way, and that what he's tried to do with the Tory party is what Tony Blair did with the Labour Party. In other words, take the things that are seen as scary out of it, but support what exactly? And I think that was the ultimate problem with Blairism. I didn't really see, apart from some of the early comments, that the moral compass seemed to go. I think Robin Cook's death was a major loss. Major loss. Indeed. To the Labour government when it happened, because I think you had somebody who had a lot of people like myself had a lot of respect for, who had never been in the Labour Party, who had a moral compass, as we saw over Iraq, and had a commitment to constitutional change, and I think without that you end up with a position as the Tory party has in its time, and I think the Labour Party is now, where being in government is an aim for its own sake, and I think that it always leads to bad government.
Now, do you think possible, both of you, that these resignations have happened because some of these people felt that they were about to be reshuffled out of the cabinet and they would rather go before that happened?
Well, we're speculating here. We don't know what might have happened. What has very much annoyed Labour activists, with Hazel Blears, for example, is that if you are going to resign, you can resign months ago or you can resign next week after the election. As David Cameron said, for the local government minister to resign on the eve of an election is absolute sabotage. And of course, when Hazel Blears, she said she was going to go back to Salford to represent her constituents, and they did a vox pop in Salford city centre, and the remarks were unprintable. And this is the problem with New Labour, is that they fail to understand that they are not actually as popular as they think they are. They never were.
Okay, so
now they're jumping the Brown government, but they are in fact not going to benefit from this, because the ordinary people out there, especially the loyal Labour people, the pensioners, for example, who vote for us, they are furious with this kind of stuff.
I mean, the Hazel Blears situation is interesting. I mean, she's someone who presents quite well, but I've seen her at a number of local government conferences, and you always feel that the speech is quite well delivered, but it's empty of content.
Yeah.
And I think that's been her biggest problem. But you see, the difficulty is Gordon Brown. They merge into one after a while. Gordon Brown, a couple of weeks ago, goes on the television and says what she did was unacceptable. Now, in that situation, she should either go voluntarily or he should have sacked her. So what then happens is he makes it clear he's going to reshuffle her out of the cabinet, which is almost certainly what was going to happen, or give her something that she regarded as a demotion. The one thing I do believe about her is she did say she wanted the communities and local government portfolio, and I heard that at local government association conference. I think she probably did. But, you know, having made that comment about what she did, then you've got to follow through and get rid of her. Because otherwise, what are you left with? You're left with saying your behaviour was unacceptable, but you're still there because I haven't found your replacement yet. You know, it's a bit like working your notice. Yeah.
So do you both think that the Labour Party is going to the left and the right, the cabinet, or is the cabinet going to collapse?
I'll try and be as brief as possible to make my point here. I believe in proportional representation. I always have, not because for tactical reasons. We need proportional representation because it allows a wider spread of views to be expressed. Yeah. And I'm quite happy for under a proportional system for Steve to be the centre ground and we will be the left. And that traditionally was the position between our two parties. But now, of course, New Labour have strung us out so far to the right that you, without moving, are now to our left.
Yeah, I think you can have a debate about where parties are. I have a historical view of this, that actually the development of the Labour Party in its form was not something that was inevitable, and that had the Liberal Party in Edwardian times changed, we would now have something rather like the Democratic Party on the centre-left of politics, which is where I am. That didn't happen for a number of reasons, and so we've got this rather odd system. The interesting thing about Labourism in Britain is it never fully, I don't think, embraced socialism in the way that it did on the continent. But one of the strengths of the continental countries with proportional representation is it does enable clarity about what parties stand for to come
Absolutely.
Out. And one of the problems with the biggest drawback with first-past-the-post in national elections is that what it means is that the key voters that matter are a small number of swing voters in 150 marginal seats. And for most of the country, that is not the case. So you see the general election message targeted at a tiny number of swing voters. That's why you end up with the Cameron situation. That's why you end up with Tony Blair and New Labour, because you're not actually saying this is our basic principle. And it might go up or down a percentage, depending on how you ebb and flow. But you're actually speaking to your whole... to the whole population and seeing what your vote is. And then once you get there, then you can form coalition government that takes that into account. What happens now with first past the post is that coalitions are within parties rather than without them.
And therefore it's opaque what's going on.
And it's opaque where politics is, because, you know, I mean, it's quite interesting. I have some involvement with the local government association, and I meet a lot of actually very... committed people who want to do good for their community and their area. And some of them, I think, actually, who are fairly centre ground, they could have been in any one of the three parties, or possibly even the Greens in some cases, but they're where they are because of either geography, accident of birth, or whoever happened to recruit them first. Now, in a coalition situation, you can bring that together. At the moment, our system polarises that.
But of course, the argument against proportional representation, and I think it's fair to say we may be seeing a revisiting of this after this expenses crisis, is that it leads to weak government, and that all of the different parties are squabbling to try and get together
this
policy.
This is tired old GCSE politics, in my view. I mean, look at all the other countries in Europe. It's very interesting. I used to be an aid worker in Eastern Europe, and it's very significant that every single Eastern European country, when they designed their newly democratic systems after 1989, they all, without exception, chose a PR system, which was absolutely consistent with most Western European countries. And, of course, dialogue and coalition is normal in Denmark, in Sweden, in Italy. It's normal. It's only in Britain where what we do every 5 years is we elect the new king, who then decides everything.
And it is literally that. I mean, a lot of the powers that government exercise are the sovereign in Parliament. I mean, you know, there's no debate. There's things like orders in council, you know, that are not debated. But on your point about stability, I mean, I would just say this. We've now had an election in Bristol that's delivered a small overall majority for my party, the Liberal Democrats. We have had no overall control since 2003. We've had 6 years of instability under first past the post. There's no guarantee, although proportional representation may make that more likely, the reason it makes it more likely is because it represents the way people are. And I'm in a rather unusual position. I was talking to Martin outside before we come in. I now represent a party that has 51% of the seats on Bristol City Council for 39% of the vote. Now, I'm actually saying, yeah, we will exercise power and we'll do our best for Bristol, but actually that's wrong. We should not have that. We are overrepresented. And so for once, the system is unfair to the Labour and Tory parties and is biased in favour of the Liberal Democrats because we finished first. And that's as wrong as it is in national politics when the tables are reversed.
Thanks, Steve. Now, I'm just going to run through the election results for tomorrow. But just before we do that, I wonder if you can explain, Steve, the way that the elections work here, because it's not, I think, isn't it, in some sort of weird rotation where certain seats 1 year, the next year no seats, the year after another separate set of seats. So can you just explain that for us?
Yes, I can. Bristol, in common with a lot of major cities, most major cities actually, Liverpool, Newcastle, Birmingham, Sheffield, etc., has what's called elections by thirds, where a third of the council retire and seek re-election. So you have an election every year for a third of the council, and the fourth year you don't have elections. Originally, it was every year, literally, and then the reason we have the gap year is because Avon County Council was abolished. Now, this is people around Bristol don't understand that, but that's the common system in major cities. Where Bristol is odd, and it's been odd for 25 years, is that having agreed that that's the way we wanted to run it, and there's good democratic reasons, actually, for having a third of the council retiring every year, which we might come on to later. Where Bristol is odd is that we have elections by thirds in two-seat wards. Now, most of those, all of those other cities I mentioned, they have three-seat wards, so they have elections in the whole city. The oddity of Bristol is that at the time the legislation was put in, you could only have thirds or everything. You could not have elections by halves, which would make sense in two-seat wards.
Yeah, sounds like a pretty complicated system. But why is this good for democracy, you were saying?
Well, I think it's good for democracy because what it means is that change can happen. You can change the administration, but the electors have a voice every year. The other thing it avoids is the sort of situation which you've had in North Somerset, where you have big swings of opinion leading to a wholesale clear out of councillors of one party and the coming in of a load of councillors from the other, and then the same thing happening in reverse 4 years later. Because the danger with that system is what actually happens is that you lose the people who know their way around the system and have the expertise. You gain a load of people who are inexperienced. And my fear, and I've told officers this, is that what happens is that then council officers make the decisions and not elected people.
Well, we may be coming on to that a little bit later, but I'd like to now just simply run through some of the election results for those of you that haven't heard them. And also, I was almost tempted to buy a copy of the Evening Post today, but apparently these results aren't yet in there. Anyway, this is from the Bristol City Council website. So Ashley Ward is a Lib Dem hold. Avonmouth was a Conservative gain. Bishopston is a Lib Dem hold. Cabot Ward was a Lib Dem hold. Clifton Ward is a Lib Dem hold. Clifton East, again, a Lib Dem hold. Cotham, Lib Dems held that. Easton was a Lib Dem hold. Eastville, a Lib Dem hold. Frome Valley, a Conservative gain. Henbury, a Conservative gain. Henlees, a Lib Dem hold. Hillfields, a Lib Dem gain. Horfield, a Lib Dem gain. Kings Weston, a Lib Dem gain. Lawrence Hill, a Labour hold. Lochlea's, a Lib Dem hold. Redland, a Lib Dem hold. Southmead, a Lib Dem gain. St George East, a Conservative gain. And St George West, a Labour hold. And finally, Stoke Bishop is a Conservative hold. Now, is this really going to make any difference, Steve? Because essentially, there's going to be no change. The Lib Dems were in control before the election.
Oh, it makes a big difference because one of the...
Sorry.
Yes, it makes a big difference. We've had what we call minority control. And one of the problems is councils aren't allowed to choose how they run their business. Government imposed what's called a cabinet system, where you elect a cabinet, a bit like the national one. Full council elects a cabinet and then they get on with it. Now, if you have minority control, that happens and the cabinet can take decisions. But you can end up paralysed, being subject to call-ins, where decisions are challenged and then have to go back through the system, or you can have a position where the scrutiny process can delay things coming in, or you have difficulty in getting your budget through and what have you. Now, with an overall majority, you don't have that problem, and it's much clearer that decisions will stick once they're agreed. And we saw that in the last year with the with two things. Firstly, with the budget, where in 2008 the Labour Party accepted Conservative amendments to their budget. In 2008 and 2009, the Conservatives initially supported the building of a mass burn incinerator in the Severnside area, and then opposed it at the budget meeting. So we ended up with a position where we had a policy switch by the third party changing its position. Labour were always in favour of this mass burn incineration project funded by private finance initiative. Liberal Democrats were always against it. The Conservatives vacillated, so we ended up with a rather messy position of having gone part the way down the road to one of these bids to government and then pulling back.
Okay. So what about, let's tackle some of the specific issues. I think for many people, I mean, you've got a transport portfolio in the Cabinet, and people feel that the transport is a major issue in the city that needs, I mean, there may be people sitting out there in traffic jams right now wondering, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, and I think one of the difficulties, I was talking to one of my fellow councillors at lunchtime today, and he said he, in the city of Alicante in Spain, he went and visited. They had a transport problem. They were able to actually resolve it. They were able to build a tram system, go to the money market, go to their people, have bonds, and actually raise the money. The problem here is that local government doesn't have that power. And in order to sort out the buses, this is what has to happen. We have to put a bid together, along with Bristol, along with its neighbours in South Gloucestershire and Bath and so on. And lots of lawyers, and you paid lots of lawyers and accountants a lot of money to produce a glossy bid document and supporting papers, and they go off in a lorry to London. They then go to the Secretary of State, along with lots of other bids from other cities, and another load of lawyers and accountants crawl over it, and then decide who gets doled out the money. I'd far rather we said, well, let's actually stop paying lawyers and accountants and people who write glossy publications lots of money, and actually invest it in buying buses and employing bus drivers and putting trams in. But the problem is, we have this rather insane position of, you know, this sort of death by process and accountancy, and government doling out money like sort of crumbs from the rich man's table. And I think we should change the relationship between central and local government. And if councils want to provide services, and that's what their voters want, they should be empowered to get on with it.
Okay. Do you think that's is that feasible? Is this going to happen?
Well, it happens most everywhere else in Europe and North America and in the developed world. Britain and Greece, I think, are the most centralised countries in the EU, where everything seems to have to be approved by ministers, government offices, regional development authorities, and, you know, vast armies of sort of bureaucrats and ministers looking at it. I mean, I actually work as a civil servant, so I mean, I'm not defending my own vested interests here very well, perhaps, but, you know, I do think that the system is wrong, and we need to get more power back to the people. And the fact that we haven't got that causes a frustration, because people lose confidence in the ability of people they elect locally to deliver, because so much has to come through the ministerial thing. And the problem is, Tory and Labour governments have both said they want to abolish quangos and so on, and as soon as they get into power, all they do is create more.
Can I agree with a lot of that, obviously. I mean, it's perfectly straightforward that the power should be devolved. But I do think that there is a case for overall planning. That's why I'm a socialist. When people talk about lotteries in the NHS, postcode lotteries, yeah, where in certain parts of the country you can get certain drugs, in other parts you can't get. The problem with decentralisation, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have decentralisation for lots of decisions, they should, but if we're talking about things like healthcare, it shouldn't matter which part of the country you come from, what kind of healthcare you get. And I still believe in a degree of central planning. That's why I'm a socialist, and that's why I'm not in your party.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I mean, I think you need to have some sort of basic minimum standards in operation here. But beyond that, I do think there should be flexibility. I mean, you know, not far from here, you go across the Severn Bridge, and they've got different services in terms of things like prescription charges and dentistry charges and so on. And I think that's fine. People vote for a Welsh Assembly government knowing that one of their priorities is that. They'll be taxed accordingly. And I don't have too much of a problem with that. And I think if major cities and towns could make those sorts of decisions locally, then that would be far better. It's a lot of road decisions, for instance, are made by the Department of Transport. Now, I accept that you need a motorway system and a trunk road system in operation, as you do with rail. You need infrastructure. But beyond that, it should be able to be done locally. I'd actually devolve much more locally within Bristol. I mean, I think a lot of decisions about street cleaning and street lighting and pavements and so on could be done by locally based area structures rather than by the centralised city council. So I think it's not a devolution just to local government. I'd go further.
But it sounds to me like you've just almost given up this fight to take command of the transport infrastructure and the transport situation in the city.
No, I mean, you've got to work with I don't like the bid system and the Transport Innovation Fund and all the bureaucracy that goes with it. But, I mean, the reality is we have to be in the game because that's the way the rules are drawn up. And so we have supported a bid to the TIF. I'd like to see much more priority being given to local rail investment in Bristol. I think that would be good. I'd like to see the Porter's Head line open and the Henbury Loop and so on. But until you get ministers to change the way they allocate resources, then that's going to be very difficult. But we should still keep arguing the case. And with something like the Severn Beach line, we've showed that by some hard negotiation with the train operating company and some investment from the authority, we were able to improve the service.
Well, okay, let's move on to housing. We had a piece last week about quite a lot of Bristol City Council's own housing, which has kind of hit deadlock, which means this is land which was due to be taken over by Bovis Homes and various other people to develop it. And because of the situation, financial situation, this land is now there, sitting there, and houses are sitting there, council houses, empty, whilst we've got something like 20,000 people waiting for somewhere to live.
I think one of the worst things that ever happened in my first stint on the council, which was in the 1980s, was the Conservative government's way they introduced right to buy. I'm in Bristol under Labour control, and I don't think my party opposers at the time always sold council houses, but was able to reinvest the money and build others. And I think that's the problem. You weren't allowed to local authorities weren't allowed to reinvest the proceeds into more social housing, and so we've got huge problems. Now, one of the things that I would like to actually see councils having the freedom to choose how they do it. So if they want to build council houses, then I think they should be allowed to borrow the money and do it. And you borrow the money off future rents, clearly, because over a period of time the rents pay for it. But also some more imaginative schemes. Some of the mixed schemes have been very good. Upper Horfield is one in Bristol with the Community Housing Federation, where you've got a mixture of social housing and private accommodation. I think that's good. I don't like large ghettos of council houses and large ghettos of private houses. I'd prefer to have a mixture of people. I think that's better for social cohesion. But I think we've got to find a way of funding it. And I've been on something that the Regional Assembly had called the Housing Forum that has looked at imaginative ways of unlocking things. But it's about making provision available. And you need to do that at a number of levels. But the level which is failing most is in the rented sector, for those whose only option is rental. And the housing list situation which you refer to is caused by a lack of supply, not by an over-optimistic demand.
But Steve, this is a little bit like the transport situation, isn't it? Where you're saying basically, look, we'd like to do this, but our hands are tied.
Well, they are to an extent. I'd like to see more freedom being given. I mean, one of the things about Bristol is that in many ways, it's a cash-poor but rather asset-rich local authority, and we do have a lot of land holdings. Now, we need to release some of those, and it may be that we need to reassess what we were hoping to get in terms of capital receipt for investment and say, well, the more pressing need is to provide housing.
But so you're talking about selling off the family silver, a bit more of the family silver, because surely that land holding is one of the main sort of mainstays that's the sort of asset for the whole city.
Well, land holding that's doing nothing is worthless. I think, you know, we need to use the city's resources to provide services for people. And maybe if land prices drop, this is a maybe, but maybe we ought to look at acquisition
not be the best time at the moment to be selling land, yeah.
No, it might be a good time to be buying then. Maybe we ought to be looking at that.
Okay, and this one's for both of you. Now, what about an elected mayor? We keep hearing this one popping up its head. Do you think Barbara Jank would make a nice elected mayor? Do you think people would vote for her?
Oh, they may well do. I mean, an election for mayor would probably go down on party lines, which is largely the case. I think that the problem with the elected mayor system is I ask the question, what is the problem you're trying to solve by an elected mayor? And I think one of the problems, you know, local press like it, local radio like it, because you've got a figurehead you can throw brickbats at. But in reality, if you don't change some of these fundamental structural issues and you just have an elected mayor with the current powers, you're not taking anything further forward. I don't like concentration of power behind single individuals. I think that's wrong. And I don't think an elected mayor, given where we are with local government, is fine. If you offer me an elected mayor with the powers that, say, the mayor of Paris or the mayor of New York or the mayor of Rome has, then I might be prepared to look at it, but not under the current structure of local government.
Well, I mean, we were talking earlier about electing a king once every 5 years in Westminster elections, and I think the problem with elected mayors is exactly that. It's all focused on personality. I mean, and, you know, it could easily, you know, we could have celebrity mayors and all the rest of it. Now, I think local government should be a bit more boring than that. It should be run by committees and consensus and discussion, and no one person should be in a position. I say this, of course, I think Ken Livingstone did a very good job of being the elected mayor of London when he was one. But at the same time, it's not really an appropriate... I mean, I think he would probably agree it's not exactly the appropriate way. He said, I'm going to stand for elected mayor because that's what's on the table. Mm-hmm. But he actually said, I don't actually really believe in this. And I don't believe in it either.
I mean, I spend a lot of time in London going to meetings either with the trade union or with the local government association. I think one of the problems with the elected mayor thing is it does become a massive ego thing. I mean, you know, you used to see Ken Livingstone's picture on just about everything with Mayor of London that you know he really didn't deal with. It was dealt with as it would be in any local authority. But you badge it, and I'm sure it's happening to the same extent with his successor. And I just feel, I mean, one of the problems with Livingstone was his relationship with the Greater London Authority that was elected. And I just don't think within the current English structure of local government, it's an improvement. It's not making a valid change at all. Give it more power, give it an elected council to work alongside it with some teeth, then maybe, but not now.
Okay, now, what about the council officers? Because, of course, they're the permanent people running the council, and they've not been elected. But, I mean, surely they're the people they're sitting there thinking, well, I mean, we don't get sacked, or no one's electing us. Aren't they really in the driving seat when there's councillors swapping around and the council officers are still there permanently? Jan Ormeroyd, isn't she really running the council?
I think it's a question of whether you're talking about running the council in terms of the service delivery or whether you're talking about the policy structure. Now, much of what the council does is administrative. If you're running housing benefit or the housing service or adult community care, then much of that would tick over whatever the political party in power is. I don't want to go down the American line of sort of electing everybody from the dog catcher to the... I don't think that's particularly effective. And what should happen is that it should be a very simple divide, that the officers carry out the policy and the electorate through their representatives decide what the policy is. I think the difficulty is when it becomes blurred, and when it becomes blurred, officers start behaving like politicians and politicians start behaving like quasi-officers, and both scenarios are wrong.
Martin?
Well, I mean, I don't have such an intimate knowledge of the working of the council that, as Steve does, so I haven't... I think there's always going to be a problem in a representative democracy about how you carry things out and who's going to carry them out. I mean, the civil service in Britain, the national civil service, is supposedly impartial. I mean, you were saying earlier about... Mm-hmm. I mean, when Obama takes over in the US, the whole civil service, top level, is completely replaced by a whole new bunch of people. Now, that's not the way we do it in Britain, and I think that's much better to have a professional civil service. Where I think the professional civil service let us down very badly was as the banking crisis developed. Do you remember they had to sit down and had to spend 2 days and draw up a plan for dealing with the banking crisis? And they brought Curry in, and the civil servants didn't go home. And I'm pretty shocked about that, because my understanding is that the British civil service should have had a plan to nationalise the banking system, probably dusted off from 1948. It should have been in the drawer. It should have been there. Now, what happens? They've failed in their duty to provide us with the option. They're on the back foot. And that's because they've got used to the idea that as long as they do what the politicians say, that's enough. Now, the civil service ought to be thinking about plan A, yes. B, C and D. Yeah.
Yes, it ought to be. I think one of the things, I mean, as Vince Cable said at the time of the banking crisis, what we've actually done is nationalise the risk and privatise the profits, which seems to be a ridiculous position. Now, I think, and he was saying, I mean, nationalisation is not something my party supports as a rule, but there
we
are
do.
Times.
We do.
Well, you say you do.
No, but, I do. No, you do. Yeah. New Labour don't. New Labour I do. No.
But I mean, there are times when you have to do it, albeit as a temporary experience. I mean, expedient. I can remember in, you know, when I was in secondary school, that a Conservative government nationalised Rolls Royce. It then took it back into the private sector, but it had to stop it going under because of the threat to jobs and technology. So, and I think the same should have happened with the banks. But, you know, Northern Rock directors seem to be calling the shots in dictating terms when, you know, ordinary people like Martin and I were paying the bills, and that was wrong.
Well, it's been a really enjoyable 45 minutes chatting about the elections, and I hope you'll join us again in some future weeks, Steve.
Thank you.
We're going to have some music now, but after that we'll be hearing about the redevelopment of Castle Park. Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky. And we're going to start now with a piece by Adam. And Adam's going to be talking about the developments in Castle Park. Now, Adam, why do you think it's a bad idea to redevelop Castle Park?
Yeah, well, from my point of view, I'm from Poland. It's like so-called redevelopment. is just to try to get rid of very important place in Bristol, like very important symbol of the city.
So what symbol? What's so important about this, the symbol, and what symbol specifically?
Just this place, a Castle Park, symbolizes two historical events. First of them is a destruction of the Royalist castle done by Oliver Cromwell during Civil War. And the second, the most more recent, is like a Bristol bombing done by the Nazi Air Force in 1940s.
Okay, but why is this so important for Bristolians living now in the 21st century? It's a long time ago.
You know, it's about common culture memory, I would say. It works like that. People are working with children in the Castle Park, and then kids see the church without the roof. And they are asking questions. Mommy, Daddy, why this building has no roof? Yeah, you know it.
Well, I asked that question when I first saw it too.
Yeah. So this way parents are forced to tell the story about this place, which is also a story of people struggling with evil, in my opinion.
Okay, so how is Castle Park used nowadays?
So when I'm passing through or just sitting on the grass, I see plenty of people like getting a good rest from work, chatting with friends, eating own homemade food, not shopping around.
Okay, what's your message that you want to send to Bristolians then?
It's like just people from Bristol, do everything you can think of to keep the Castle Park as it is now. Don't let replace this symbol of local people's fighting for freedom by another symbol of greedy capitalism, like another useless shopping circus or bunch of luxury apartments where no one of you can afford to live.
Adam Dubrovsky, thank you very much. I hope we'll be having some more from you in future weeks.
Thank you.
It's over to Marina Morris, who has been looking at longevity across Europe. Marina.
Yes, people living longer, but this causing for problem. Europe is aging, but European governments just beginning to recognize this problem.
Okay, so what has the British government done to address the longevity crisis?
British life expectancy over the past century has increased. The typical British male's lifespan increased from 48 in 1901 to 75 in 2000, and a female's from 49 to 80. The official responsible for making projections have assumed that life expectancy will increase slowly. The official forecast distort people's decisions about how much to save and when to retire. They give politicians a license to postpone adjustments to social security and a medical care system. Employers are looking to shed staff in a recession and looking closely at retirement. Policymakers are now just beginning to recognize the potential significance of increasing life expectancy. It's not clear that the British policymaking process has fully adapted.
Okay, so what can people do to defer their longevity crisis, you know, if it's going to be a problem?
The keywords are lifestyle and change. Scientists have found that a healthy lifestyle and family history are very important. Living in the countryside, a health-balanced diet help, but smoking, drug-taking and drinking habits increase the risk of an early death. A wide gap in life expectancies between rich and poor persists, which professionals enjoying far longer lives than their low-skills contemporaries. A male lawyer can expect to live over 7 years longer than the man who empties his waste paper bin, according to the office, the national statistic. Also, life might be entertainment. Don't forget it. Depressed people tend to die younger. We need life to be filled with interest and physical activities. A brisk walk would do the job, perhaps 25 minutes. Some mental activities, intellectual exercise is important to keep the brain fit. And copy and learn a modern lifestyle. 83 years old Queen Elizabeth is now oldest monarch on the British throne and has beaten the record of her grand-grandmother, Queen Victoria, who lived for 81 years.
I'm afraid we're going to have to just hold you there, Marina, and I think this is really interesting stuff. I know you're away next week, but can we resume week after next, hearing all about how amazingly well the royal family have done? Anyway, it's coming up to 6 o'clock, and that's all we have time for this week. You can join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time every week here on BCFM, where we'll be doing our best to pick apart some of the less well-reported news in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you've got news you want discussed here, questions about tonight's programme, or would like to discuss a topic for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. We'll be back next week with some analysis of the European election results, as well as anything else that crops up, thanks to our reporters Marina Morris and Adam Dubrovsky. Election analysis and review of this week's other news was by Martin Summers and Lib Dem councillor for Eastville, Steve Coomer. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and fruitful weekend. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the bankers get you down.